about our future, both sides say. But is it a future in which oil production will continue to go down, but not as fast if we just take less for it? Or a future in which a greater diversity of producers get tax credits and the big producing oil fields get no break from having to pay more when they get windfall profits? Good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. The Ballot Measure 1 referendum is again the subject. Phone number 1-800-478-8255, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422. You can call right now. Should Senate Bill 21 be given a chance to work? The subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, we're revisiting this subject by popular request, and we're getting close to decision time. It's just a few weeks away, and early voting has actually already started, and a campaign for early voting is already starting on Ballot Measure 1. It's one of the most important things on the primary election ballot, but not the only thing by any means. But it's the one we're talking about. The last show was really interesting. We had Mr. Doug Smith, who is in the oil field services business, on the anti-ballot measure one, anti-repeal side. And we had Senator Bert Stedman for the pro-repeal side. And there was a really interesting and informative show, and I'm hoping for even more from this one. I have very well-informed guests. On the anti-side, the vote no on one side, Brad Keithley of Keithley Consulting. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Brad.
Thank you, Steve. Good to see you today.
Brad, I thought of you as a kind of oil company person, but you're basically an attorney, right?
Well, my training is as an attorney. I've got a law degree, and I practiced law for a number of years, focusing on oil and gas law. But in the last couple of years, I've stepped back from the day-to-day practice of law, and I'm doing consulting now.
And you've got a blog.
I do.
Which has a following.
I do have a blog. Well, it has something of a following. It's bgkeithley.com, and I try to address what I think are the important issues about oil, gas, and fiscal policy in the state.
And I first ran into you when you were it was at one of those conferences Institute of the North
right.
had, because you're on the board. I don't know if you're still on the board or not.
I am still on the board.
And we had a really interesting conversation about the problems with ACES at that time.
Yeah.
And you said, trust me, it needs to be fixed.
Yeah. You could see the problems with ACES in terms of declining investment relative to the investment that was going on in the rest of the world fairly early. In 2009, there was a New York Times article that was talking about booming investment in the oil industry, huge numbers, a huge activity level in the oil industry, and Alaska was just sort of rocking along at the same level. So you could see the separation between what was going on in the rest of the world and what was going on in Alaska even then.
Investment choices being made.
Well, more dollars coming in. Oil prices were going up. More dollars were coming into the industry, but Alaska wasn't staying at its historical share. Dollars were going off other places in the world. New activity was going off other places in the world.
Also with me is, and joining us by phone from Fairbanks, is the former director of the State Oil and Gas Division and later on of the U.S. Geologic Survey, I think it became called Service, Mark Myers. Mark, welcome to Talk of Alaska. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
So where were you when the price of oil last went down and then came back up?
Well, when it came down back severely, that was in the early 80s. I was working for one of the oil companies, watched half my friends get laid off, but kept my job and worked from exploration to development and worked on infield development in the Kuparuk River oil field after I was doing frontier exploration up here on the North Slope. So we weathered our way through it, like everyone else, with a low price of oil, but it sure shows you the dependency of the price of oil in terms of levels of activity.
And then what Brad was talking about the lack of investment that we were seeing, like quite about 2008 or 2009?
Well, the industry started jumping in investment in 2005. As oil prices came up, industry investment levels went up. In fact, if you measure it from 2005 to 2013, annual investment levels for the industry have jumped 150%. In the U.S. Over that period from 2005 to 2013. It hasn't done the same in Alaska.
No, yeah. But then we had kind of an economic collapse. The price of oil went down in 2008.
Yeah. It did, and there was a leveling off. But yeah. if you look at the activity levels back in 2005 and look at them in 2013, there's been, with that slight leveling during that period, there's just been a huge increase.
Right. Now,
yeah, Steve, during that time, I was director of the USGS, and we were doing assessments. We came out in 2008 with a new assessment for the Bakken prior to it really ramping up. At the same time, you know, what had really happened was a change in technology, that the work being done with shale gas was being converted over to shale oil and horizontal and fracking in low-quality reservoirs in the Permian Basin in Texas and the Eagle Ford formation in Texas, and then in the Bakken in North Dakota, took off. And then we saw a ton of independent operators in those basins really take off and start drilling wells. Higher cost structure, because we had crossed that paradigm. Right about that time in 2005, we first crossed $50 a barrel per oil. That was the first time in history we had done that. And then by 2008, we were seeing up to $140. It was our peak. And then it leveled off around $100, $110 a barrel now. But that is sufficient enough to drive that new technology. So very different situation than on the North Slope. The geology is very different. The infrastructure is different. The nearness to market's different. So we're looking at apples and oranges when we really compare those, that expansion lower 48.
So what would you say about the investment dollars? It's so much investment dollars, and there's more investment dollars coming in because the price is going up all the way up to 140.
Uh-huh.
And so Brad is saying, look, they made the decision to go to that frontier area instead of Alaska.
Well, the thing under ACE is some of them did come up here, and we started to see the exploration. But we've been dominated by infield development of old fields that are in their late in their field life. They're, you know, in Prudhoe Bay are remaining maybe 3 billion barrels, optimistically, and we've produced, you know, probably 15 billion out of the field. So we're looking at our last 20% of oil in these big fields, and you simply treat those differently than you do the exploration plays. With the exploration plays, you needed many more companies to come up, and we simply have not attracted enough of those independent companies for a lot of reasons, but it certainly wasn't the tax structure. ACES was actually more friendly to those smaller companies, and the ones that did come up really testified on behalf of it and really supported it. So really, I can go through the players in those other basins, but the majors are not major players. They're involved, but you can go through the major producers in the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, and the Permian. You have to go pretty far down the list before you start hitting any of our majors. They're really small companies, names you may not have heard of. But companies like Apache, which have come to Cook Inlet, are in that group. So fundamentally, we have just not attracted the right investors. And without that huge number of investors, they're drilling 400 or 500. There's 400 or 500 wells, for example, rigs in the Permian Basin as we speak. I think about 455.
So you're saying
very
that,
different.
Yeah,
profile.
Under ACES, the tax credits under ACES was actually attractive to these new and smaller scale investors.
Right. So a couple of differences again in the geology. One is the geologic success rate is much higher in those other basins when you're drilling for shale because you know where the shale is.
I would think so. Yeah.
So you don't have a lot of capital risk with respect to exploration, but you have high power development costs. So in Alaska, we're still looking primarily at conventional with opportunities for heavy and viscous oil and some for shale, but primarily we're still looking at conventional field development, whether it be in the Beaufort, the Chukchi, MPRA, on state lands. And when you look at those opportunities, those have high exploration risk legs to them. A new company coming up, if it gets a capital credit, can cash that credit out immediately. If it gets a production credit, it has to wait till it has production. So it has a 10-year lag between when it gets the credit and when it can use it. And so that's a big difference for a smaller company. They have to turn cash flow. A bigger major that already has production has an advantage in that situation competitively. Now, so we've competitively advantaged the existing major producers, which are good companies, but we haven't attracted the smaller companies under the current system.
But, Brad Keithley, you see it differently. You say that these credits essentially were attracting investment in places that might not be the best place bang for the buck.
Yeah, if you look at what Alaska's potential is, there is a significant amount of potential. It lies in two places. There, as Mark's discussing, there's potential outside the existing units, but there's also additional potential inside the existing units. The way we define units, we define them in big geographical areas.
Boy, howdy, I guess we do.
But when you look below the surface, there are different pools inside those units. From 2000 to 2007, for example, there were 14 new pools developed. This is before ACES. 14 new pools developed. A lot of them were new productions we were opening up within the existing units as the economics justified going ahead and doing the step out. That's where, when you look at the reserve base and look at the potential, that's where a significant amount of the potential remains. It remains in those existing units, going and getting the additional pools that are in those existing geographic areas. They were defined out. They weren't treated as new areas under ACES. So what you had was a very high tax system for the existing units that essentially was funding credits for people to go out and explore in new areas. And there were a small amount of fines. There were six new pools added from 2007 to the current, as compared to the 14 that occurred from 2000 to 2007. But you weren't finding the additional amount of oil that we need to replace the decline rate in those new areas. And what you found was we were disincentivizing going after the additional oil that was in the existing units because of the high tax rate we'd imposed on it. SB 21 changes that in two respects. One, it changes it by treating the new areas, the yet-to-be-developed areas within the existing units, as new areas and gives them the advantage of the same lower tax rate that the outside areas had. And the second change, frankly, which is very important, is we change from a credit, from a subsidy system, which we were operating under ACES, to a production credit system. The credits had grown under ACES from about $25 million when ACES began. In the last year, fiscal year 2013, that ACES was in effect, the credits were $600 million. We were paying $600 million out of the state treasury to subsidize those activities out in fields that weren't producing, that weren't bringing additional significant quantities of additional oil on.
But did we know that yet?
Well, Steve, can I answer that question real quick?
Yeah, sure.
Because I have, again, a very different take on it than Brad does. So first of all, there were production credits under ACES. I think a 25% credit was given for production. There were capital credits against new infrastructure. There were greater credits up to 40%, I believe, with exploration. So credits were tiered both to development and to exploration under ACES. Secondly, the fields internally, and I worked on development of these fields, and I worked on exploration. In fact, I had a couple discoveries. I worked on, as a geologist, and several discoveries of some of these satellite fields. I can tell you the economics we're seeing now in those fields was amazing under ACES. And we're seeing in an average net, based on Conoco's number, under 2012 under ACES of about $30 a barrel. And lately, Conoco's numbers report out about $35 a barrel profit after all expenses on oil from those infrastructures. So in other words, those rates of profits far exceed what they're getting in the lower 48 on similar fields. $6 a barrel is the average for Conoco in the lower 48, and they're getting, again, 35 on the North Slope under the current quarter. So the question is, they were economic, but what wasn't happening was a lot of new infield infrastructure being built to handle with the limitations with water and gas in the fields. And then secondly, the exploration credits never had time to work. It takes 5 to 10 years. I mean, I'm an explorationist. You spend several years interpreting or getting seismic data, interpreting it. You have several years more before you get the permits to drill through first well. Then you have to drill delineation wells, design facilities, and build them. 10-year process, and we cut it off right when it was starting to bear fruit. And when I look at the resource numbers, we have about 5 billion barrels of in-place proven reserves in all the fields together. And then we have another 30 to 37 billion barrels of potential resource outside. So you're looking at six times the amount of potential outside than we have inside those units. And with inside the units, the biggest prize is actually the heavy oil, which isn't being accelerated in terms of development under the new system.
So, it would take a new unit then.
Many new units. and many more exploration wells, which the major producers and the production credits really don't incentivize. So we're incentivizing the tail of the dog instead of the front end of the dog on these things. And that's costing us exploration wells, and it's costing us the development of the new fields. Contrast that in the Lower 48. You have 50 companies or so in each of these basins actively drilling wells, going after it, and it's a broadly based industry. We really only have a handful. So encouraging new investors, new capital, new ideas, new technologies into the basin is the biggest challenge. And simply under the current structure, there's not much incentive for them to come.
Brad?
I don't agree with that. Under SB 21, there is as much incentive for exploration outside of the existing units as there is to go get the development in the additional development available in the existing units. Mark said that the economics justified going after those now. I've been in boardrooms. I've been in meetings where capital budgets have been allocated. At one point, I was an executive of a company, and I did some of those capital decisions. And people are relentless in the industry. If there's economic opportunity, they will go pursue that economic opportunity. They won't cut their nose off despite their face to go someplace else and try to force some sort of change. They will pursue those economic opportunities. And when you look at what happened under ACES, when you look at 2007 forward, there was only one development inside one new pool inside an existing unit that got opened up during that period. During the prior period from 2000 to 2007, there were 10 new areas inside the existing units that got opened up. So we're not discriminating against areas outside the existing units. We're just taking the same concept and applying it to new areas inside the existing units.
Okay. Well, going back to that about the developing existing pools inside the units, Mark, you were saying a lack of infrastructure. Was that a way of was that code for the bridge across the Colville Delta?
No. There clearly have been permitting issues and hiccups with the progress moving forward. And again, a lot of work needs to go into coordinating with the agencies to make sure that we do a better job of that. Agencies as well. I would like to see streamlined permitting processes to the better extent than we have now, and better coordination between the state, federal government, and the industry in those.
So, when you say infrastructure, what are you referring to? Are you referring to all the old stuff that BP had to rework?
Think of the existing fields as an old car. Let's say you've got I took the 2003 Toyota Sequoia. It has 120,000 miles on it.
That's nothing.
So it's not bad. It's got some life left in it, absolutely. Yeah. But it's not a new car. So I have to make decisions on how much I invest in that car when I take it in for the repair. And the older the car gets, the slower my investments. So there are many things that had to happen in terms of increasing the amount of water handling capacity in the field, the rates of the injectability of fluids, aging pipeline corrosion. We had the big disaster with BP and the spill, which, again, really slowed production for a while. State sued and was successful in that lawsuit against BP for lost production. But there was a lot of work that had to occur in the field in that time frame before they were ready. Actually, they were limited from putting new oil on the line because they just didn't invest in debottlenecking or creating more space in those facilities. And so again, under capital credits, under ACES, they were actually paid to do that, and they started to do that. And so now this little uptick of production that we've seen is directly related to several new units, Ugarup and Nikaichuk, coming online under ACES. And the second thing is the polymer water floods paying off in Prudhoe, and the infield drilling, which started with the rise of the price of oil, is paying off. So we're seeing that infield development occurring in the conventional units, and because they're economic, we're going to see that continue. What we're not seeing is the heavy oil development, the other big prize in the field, advancing very fast, and that's a real problem under SB 21.
Well, let me go back to that those two fields that have come on. One, I think Nikaichuk is run by Eni, the Italian company. I went to a presentation of theirs. It was just amazing at how they said, we couldn't have done this except that we're extremely horizontally integrated. They said, because we have all our own technology for doing all the stuff that is needed to deal with this kind of gunky oil that's under there and get it out in an economical way. But in no way is that the kind of gusher that Prudhoe is or the Kuparik was. You know, it's right on the edge, and they have to do a lot of quality control on that stuff before it gets to pump one.
Right, that's the kind of things, again, with the exploration and the big capital credits up front under ACES, they were recovering that money quickly before production. The state was sharing that risk. The other part is we're not talking about is how the state pays for those credits. So Brad mentioned $600 million of credits. Well, under SB 21 and 15, we're estimated by Department of Revenue put out $953 million in credits. So a third more credits on the production. And those production credits go for a lot of oil that was previously discovered, previously under development prior to the passage of SB 21.
Oh, that's
and those same units also got many of those things, like Ugruk and Kaija, got the capital credits under ACES, and now they're getting a double bonus of getting new oil credits under SB 21 because it grandfathered those units into as new units.
Yeah.
New oil.
Okay, Brad desperately wants to respond to that.
Sort of the bouncing in my seat thing. That's apples and oranges. I mean, what Mark's talking about is reduction.
More apples, more oranges.
Yeah, more apples, more oranges. What Mark's talking about is reductions in tax revenue as you produce oil. You get credits against the tax, that you're otherwise supposed to pay. What I'm talking about are absolute dollars, that checks that were written out of the state treasury to new explorers that were out there spending money, yes, but producing oil, no. And that went from $25 million a year of the state budget. Now, remember, we're dealing with a state budget that ICERS told us should be in the $5 billion range. So we're going from $25 million a year at the beginning of ACES to $600 million a year, and it was still going up under ACES.
Okay, so I get that the factual issue here is that this is a tax credit that really is a tax credit as opposed to a tax credit that's really a subsidy.
Exactly.
Well, the difference is one case you get a rebate check from the permanent, from the general fund, essentially. You pay less taxes in. The other case, and actually the way the ACES capital credits worked out the same way, they were credits against production. So they fundamentally worked the same way. The difference was you didn't have to link it to a barrel oil produced. You linked it to the capital expenditures paid, which is advantageous for new and smaller companies developing new and higher risk fields.
Hmm. Well, it's
the differences in the two systems on the credit side.
It's advantageous if we get oil out of it, but the problem under ACES is that we weren't getting additional oil out of it. We were paying out the money. People were going out and spending money, but we weren't getting additional oil out of it because we're dealing in areas that we don't know that we're going to get production out of.
I agree with you, Brad, totally that is the primary target. So you can drain the existing bathtub with those potentially 5 billion barrels quicker under an SB 21 structure, but what your ultimate target is that 30 billion barrels of other oil out there, a big chunk of that which exists on state lands. And so if you want more oil production sustained in the long run, you have to have new discoveries. And if you look at the decline curves for the North Slope, you can see the only solution to stopping decline in the long run is new oil fields being developed. ACES worked on new fields, not draining the bathtub quicker. So you're creating, as Bert Stedman said, basically a fire sale on oil that was going to be produced economically because it brings in $30 a barrel or greater profit.
Well, I disagree that oil was going to be produced anyway. The economics weren't justifying going out and getting that under that additional oil under ACES. We were paying very high tax rates in the existing fields, and that was not encouraging additional investment in those areas. The other thing, Mark, I think we agree on the importance of heavy oil going forward, but heavy oil largely lies in the existing units, and under the ACES system, the higher tax rate would apply to going after the heavy oil in the existing units. Under SB 21, they're treated as new areas, just like everything else.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know the geology that well, but I do know that if you get shallower, you get more oil, but they've not found a good way to get it out.
That's the heavy oil we're talking about, beginning to be the heavy oil that we're talking about.
But I mean, there are techniques now, but I think it almost needs to be cooked, isn't it? Doesn't it, Mark, in order to get that to come out? I mean, they've been trying as long as I've been in Alaska to get West Sac to produce.
Yeah. Well, the short technical view of this is 24 to 33 billion barrels of in-place oil within the infrastructure area of heavy and viscous oil. Some of it can be produced through some of it's lighter than others. Some of it flows fairly well. It's slightly heavier than existing oil. Some of it's like molasses. And some of it's almost like tar. And also of that, if you could recover 20%, that's, you know, of the higher end number, that's over 6 billion barrels in place. So a conservative approach, say 15%, would bring in about equal to the remaining reserves in all the other fields. To produce it, it is in the existing infrastructure area, but you need a lot of new capital investment. You need new pads. You need new wells. You need new processing facilities to produce it. So it's a capital intensive, and again, capital credits, and there were those capital credits under ACES. So the bottom line is I do think with the heavy oil, we could acknowledge it's different. So if you want an efficient tax structure, you would target and tax heavy oil differently than the light oil, which is bringing $35 a barrel for every barrel profit to the companies already, and they have every incentive to produce it.
But under S-21, as I understand it, there is a new oil has a differential rate. It doesn't get in at the 30% or 35%.
35% base.
Yeah, it doesn't get in. It gets in at a lower,
right?
More like 18.
At $135 a barrel is the only time, or $140 a barrel is the only time any oil pays 35%. The effective rate on SB21, because there's two major credits. One is for new oil, which can be old oil in new fields under PAs, participating areas, and unit expansions, etc. But of that, just looking roughly at the fields that are grandfathered in, that's about 750 million barrels of discovered and mostly producing oil. That's already going to get credit as new oil under the system because they put a bonus in there. That is going to produce at a 5% credit plus 20%, minus 20%. So the way the credit works is you take 20% off the cost of oil. So if it's $100 oil, you say it's only worth $80, and then you give them a $5 credit on top of that for new oil. Then there's a second credit. It's called the progressivity credit in there that gives you a sliding scale credit on all oil of $1 to $8 a barrel depending on oil price. So the effective rate, Senator Stedman calculates, is around 22% for 2015 for under SB21, not 35.
Okay. Let's do some phone calls.
Great.
Let's go to Kluwak. And Donna joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Donna.
Hi. Good morning. I don't have a radio, so I didn't get to hear much of the intros and anybody's position. I'm down in Southeast Alaska, and I have three questions that are just kind of interlinked to each other. What is the bottom line dollar amount per year?
Bottom line of what?
Of the tax credit.
I don't quite understand. There's tax credits, and then there's the actual tax itself, which is basically an income tax. How much is Alaska getting from the oil right now, or what?
No, what kind of break are we giving the oil companies? Do we know that?
Yeah, it's estimated in 2015, about $953 million per year in terms of credits under S21.
Okay. If this didn't go to the oil companies, where would it go, this $953 million estimated a year?
It would go to the general fund of the state treasury.
So you're talking about my state budget?
Yes.
So this $953 million a year, what is the state's plan to cover it? If it's not going to be in the state budget, because I'm hearing a lot about the jobs way up there in the north, but it's the state budget that is for me down here in Southeast Alaska, and so that's my important question: is what is the state going where will the state get that $953 million?
Okay, well, nobody's more nobody in this conversation is more concerned about state spending than Brad Keithley sitting across from me, and he favors voting no on this. He doesn't want to see Senate Bill 21 repealed. He wants to let it go to work. So let's get his side on this. Before you were talking to Mark Myers, former director of the State Oil and Gas Division, with that estimate.
So he can answer as far as where we'll get the $953 million.
Well, we'll just see.
For the state budget, because that's what my question is.
So, Donna, that's a very good question. And I think the way to look at it, the way I look at it, because I'm very concerned about where Alaska is going from a fiscal standpoint, the way I look at it is, what's going to produce more revenue for the state going forward, ACEs or SB 21? It's not really the question about credits is sort of the beginning of the question. It's how are we incentivizing, what are we paying to incentivize companies to produce? But what do we, the real question to me is, what do we get at the back end? And at the back end, it really depends upon whether SB 21 results in additional production. It doesn't have to be much additional production, but if SB 21 incentivizes additional production and we bend the decline curve, if we stop the decline by as little as 1% at certain prices, and improve our production by as little as 1% over where we're headed with ACEs, the state ends up with more money. We end up with more revenue going forward. So the
All right, but Donna's thing is this year, fiscal 15.
Yep. Under fiscal year 15, we are under either system, we have a shortage of revenue. We're down to about $4 billion, a little bit plus, in terms of revenue. And the question is, how do we get back from that? The state is not in good fiscal shape. In the last 2 years, we have run the largest deficits. Difference between spending and revenues, the largest deficits in the state's history. We have drained $6 billion. That's about a third of our cash reserves that we had 2 years ago. We've drained that out of the Treasury. So the question is, how do we improve it from here? We've got to do two things. We've got to reduce spending, but we've also got to find a way to increase revenue. And SB 21 is designed to increase investment in a way that will increase production, that will increase revenue going forward and put us in better shape.
But not necessarily in 15, although the production curve has kind of...
Production curve's flattened, yeah. Prices have softened, so revenue...
Right. So we're still...
Costs have gone up a little bit.
Yeah, go ahead,
Steve,
Mark.
This is Mark. Yeah, so to try to answer her question, first of all, any tax credits given out now for future production, you have to see what they're worth, you know. And then if you look at Greg Erickson's data, he's saying for every dollar we get back in future potential production, we spend 20. So the credits, you'd have to do the math in a much more sophisticated way that's been done to get the total picture. But the bottom line, it's a very risky and, in my opinion, a poor business decision because, again, if you don't incentivize new oil coming in, you're just producing the existing oil faster. We saw a 1% bump in production. Interestingly enough, that was predicted by Department of Revenue in 2011 based on the Nikaichek and Ugarit coming on. The Palmer water flood came on in Prudhoe, all done under ACEs, and infield drilling had taken an uptick from 2008 to 12. So we haven't seen any indication really yet of increased production, but even if we did see it, it's not primarily new oil, it's existing oil. It's draining the bathtub quicker, putting a bigger drain in the bathtub. So when you look at the deficit now, we have $1 billion additional we have to make up if you didn't have the credits. Your sources of revenue are taking out of the budget reserve fund, running the deficit bigger until that runs out, taking it from the permanent fund, or taking it from other revenue sources. The only major other revenue sources you have are personal income tax or sales tax.
Okay, I need to take a break. Donna, thank you so much for that great question and insisting on getting as much of an answer as we could render out of our guests today. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized John Deere dealer. The Anchorage location just behind the Ship Creek Salmon Fishing offers a wide range of John Deere compact tractors. CraigTaylorEquipment.com. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. You may be eligible for VA health care benefits, including reimbursement for your care at 26 tribal health care facilities and their 180-plus outlying clinics manned by providers and community health aides throughout the state of Alaska. Apply online at 1010ez.med.va.gov. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message sponsored by the VA.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about ballot measure one. If you voted for it, it's basically a referendum, and it means you're repealing an action of the legislature, Senate Bill 21, which those who advocate for repeal say is essentially a giveaway that is allowing the oil companies to take more money than they really should be entitled to. If you vote against ballot measure number one, you are voting to retain the Senate Bill 21. If you vote for it, it's going to send it back to the legislature, and basically it repeals that action by the legislature and says go to work on something new. But in the meantime, it would revert back to ACES, which we could probably debate that for the rest of the show, and I don't think we really want to, but that was the old system. And what it had that 21 does not have is progressivity. So if the price of oil were to go up to, say, $150, $160 a barrel, there's no question but what we would be very much losers under the situation. Wouldn't you admit to that, Brad Keithley?
Well, it depends on what the production level is, Steve. I mean, if by going to SB 21 we increase production and we increase the amount of units that we're taxing, then we continue to have a point, even at those higher prices, where we're getting more out of SB 21 because the pie is bigger than you do under ACES. If you just look at the existing pie and we argue and we fight about shares in the pie, then yeah, the state has a bigger share of the pie, it has more revenue. But if the consequence of SB 21 is to grow the pie, and that's what it's designed to do and intended to do, if the consequence of SB 21 is to grow the pie, a smaller, slightly smaller share of the pie, which is what the SB 21 tax rate does, nevertheless gives you more revenue because it's a smaller share of a bigger pie.
And I think also we should say, and this is what Tony Knowles argued to me, he declined to appear on the program, but he said, you know, I'd like to see those people sitting where they're sitting saying what they're saying when the price of oil went down to $9 like it did when I was governor. And, well, he had a point. I mean, that'll throw the fear of God into you. And the fact of the matter is we'd be more secure under this regime than we would under the ACES, as I understand it.
Under SB 21, yeah. If it goes down, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I add a few comments to that?
Oh, sure.
Because realistically, you know, all tax systems can bring in a huge amount of variation depending on the conditions that you model or look at. So in the work that's been done to date, you can only say what would the two systems have brought in the past. And so if you go back and look at the past under ACES versus if ACES came into effect in 2007, ended in 2013. So under those years, according to the Department of Revenue, the state collected $8 billion more in revenue than it would have under SB 21. Decline continued on the rate that's similar to what is projected to decline even after SB 21 has been put into place. So we have seen no difference, and that is because the kind of incentives in SB 21 are just going to lead to continued infield development of the existing proven reserves. You're not growing the pie. You're possibly producing the pie slightly quicker.
So we got legitimate disagreement here.
The
progressivity. The progressivity works in our favor by a multiplier at higher prices. So volatility in oil prices, like we have historically seen, brings in lots of money. A few months of higher oil prices settling back down brings you asymmetrical value or up value because the progressivity increases that rate for that month. And whether under SB 21 we take an average of a year.
Well, that's a good point.
So SB 21 brings in a lot less revenue under most likely scenarios, even with increased production, because it's not incentivizing new oil to come in from new fields. And it's also not capturing the upside.
But it's that very progressivity, it's that very volatility that keeps investors away from putting additional money in Alaska. When somebody makes an investment decision, when I did when I was an executive, as I've seen when I've been in boardrooms, when somebody makes a decision, all companies are making a decision on investments now that are going to pay out over the next 10, 15, 20 years, because that's the, you know, you build the infrastructure now, but you get the payout over that long a term. So when you're looking at the prices that you're estimating, that you're looking at for that period, you look at a range. You look at a range from $85 to $105 or $110 or $120 over that time period. The problem with ACEs is that you wouldn't really know where you were going to be in that range. So when you looked at the low end, ACEs looked okay and competitive with other places in the world. But if you started looking at the high end, ACEs was uncompetitive with other places in the world. By and large, in the rest of the world, rates are flat across a price range. So ACEs made it very difficult for companies to be comfortable making investments in Alaska, because within their range, there were points at which they were competitive. And
I wish the radio audience could see your gestures here. You're almost going on the blackboard.
Yeah, that's the professor in me coming out. But the very thing that Mark's talking about, the very volatility that Mark's talking about, was the thing that led investors to go to other places.
Let's go to Delta Junction and Shelley. Shelley, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Brad Keithley and Mark Myers.
Thank you. Yes, this is a very good debate about ACEs, should it be changed and how it should be changed. But I feel the more urgent question is SB 21 the way to do that. And there was no real debate before that. It was a measure ramrodded through by Parnell. And so it really seems like the most urgent question is, should we defeat SB 21 and then have a really good debate about ACEs and what's beneficial for the state? I mean, we're already seeing negative repercussions from SB 21 with severe cuts to our universities. And there'll be other cuts. But other cuts to give the oil companies more money. And so we need to defeat SB 21 and then really have a serious debate.
All right, Shelley, thank you. That's more of a comment than a question, I think.
Well, let me take that on a little bit. The severe cuts we're seeing in state spending, those are revenue levels that came in under ACEs. In at the beginning of 2003, ICER did a study that said the state is in a severe cash crisis. Reasonable assumptions, this is under ACEs. Reasonable assumptions suggest we do not have enough cash in reserves to avoid a severe fiscal crunch soon after 2023, and with that fiscal crisis will come an economic crash. That was under ACEs. And so what we're really looking at is, what's the best way forward? The historical debate is a nice historical debate, but the question really is, what's the best way to produce revenue for the state going forward? So it's unfair to attribute the fiscal problems that we're having currently to SB 21. They were there under ACEs.
This is Mark. Could I add a few comments to that?
Yeah, sure.
Well, a couple of things. It's interesting. Now, if I went back and looked at, you mentioned Goldsmith's report, but he did one in 85 that said 85 was when production was still ramping up, by the way. We peaked at 89. Kuparuk was just coming online. A huge amount of new oil was flowing. That by 20, expenditure levels equivalent to the 85 levels will lead to exhaustion of the permanent fund by 2002. So Brad's argument has been there for 25 years or more, or actually 30 years almost, and it has not changed the argument or debate. At some point he's right, but he's not been right yet by a long step. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a permanent fund today. We've lost that in 2002.
Well,
so if you look then at the investment, you have to run government for the next 10 years. If you deplete cash flow under SB 21 credits, don't capture upside, then we either have to borrow the money or pull it out of the permanent fund for core services. Even if you cut, again, $500 million out of the budget, you're still running a significant deficit.
Oh,
so
man,
the only chance you've got is new production.
This is really starting to hurt now. This is really starting to hurt. Let's go
That's
to Kelly.
The number show.
Yeah, let's go to Kelly. Joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Kelly.
Hey, thanks for the show, Steve. I want to talk first off about vote yes to repeal this bad law. For the first time in Alaska's history, we held basically a court-documented, illegitimate, gerrymandered election. The Republicans will say, well, the Democrats did that 10 years ago. And you know what? It didn't happen. There were lawsuits in the election that was held back then that produced a bipartisan Senate majority was legal and legitimate. The court lawsuits didn't stand, and yet in 2012, They gerrymandered it. The redistricting board dragged their feet, and even sort of under the Supreme Court saying, well, the lines are wrong, they're going to have to be redrawn after the election, right? We still had this horrible election that ousted Paskin up in Fairbanks and put these pro-giveaway crowd people that are funded by the oil companies in power. And you know, furthermore, these guys get in there, and then they pass this SB 21, which was the whole time in the Senate chaired by ConocoPhillips employees in the Natural Resources Committee, in the Finance Committee. Every committee along the line that they held hearings was chaired by ConocoPhillips employees. In a legitimate universe, we wouldn't have, when you look at the 11-9 vote in the Senate, two of those votes were, in fact, ConocoPhillips employees who disclosed their conflict of interest. Any other place in the world with an ethics, a real ethics morality about them, they would not have been allowed to vote.
So you're saying, Kelly, that they did a bad job. They were not to be trusted. They did a bad job, and we need to get rid of this.
Well, for such an
send it back to the legislature to a legislature that is less gerrymandered. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they passed the most important tax law that's going to affect this state, and we're already seeing the effects of that right now with cuts to everything and deficits showing up. ConocoPhillips just posted.
Yeah, but I think it's you know, Brad's got a real point when he says you can't really hang that one on S21.
Well, I'm not hanging on SB21. I'm just saying and pointing out that it was an illegitimate legislature that passed what I think is a very illegitimate law.
Okay.
Furthermore, where's Gaffney Klein? Why wasn't Gaffney Klein allowed to testify who crafted ACES in the first place? And you guys mentioned oil prices.
I don't know. We get the wrong people here to ask that, too. You know, maybe when Stedman was here, he could have shed some light on that one. Yeah, Kelly, I need to take a break here, so I want to can you wind up?
Yeah. Last point, when you were talking about oil prices, we're not going to see oil prices south of $100 a barrel. The organization.
Are you kidding? West Texas Intermediate is down to 96.5 or something like that this morning.
And it's projected by 2019 to go 85. The futures market is, if you look at the oil futures market, it's going down like a rock.
Yeah.
Hey, hold on.
Yeah, this is Mark again. On the oil prices, the EIA forecast, all the long-term forecasts show increasing demand and higher oil prices in the long run under the most likely scenario. So
but
I think you're right. We might see short-term blips.
This
but
is
not
fun.
Long-term.
I really have to take the break. Kelly, I want to thank you so much for your call. I think you've made your point. It was similar to the point that was made from Delta Junction earlier as Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ExxonMobil, employing over 1,000 Alaskans at their Point Thompson project, employees who are knitting hats for kids in Koktovik in their spare time. Learn more at koktovikknits.com. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Well, we did get a comment by internet that sheds a little bit of light here from Jeff, who said, Keith Lee is wrong when he says the credits were not resulting in any new oil. He quotes Pat Foley, a pioneer, who told the Senate Resources Committee, I guarantee every one of those delivered new oil. So there is that.
Well, there's data that deals with that. It shows in the six new pools that have been added since 2007, as of 2014, the largest, and in fact, really the only one really producing additional oil was at 15,000 barrels a day. If you look at the 14 new pools that were added between 2000 and 2007, there were 14, the largest of which was adding 70,000 barrels a day. So, yeah, we may be getting some additional quantities of oil, but is it worth the $600 million in annual payments that we're sending out of the Treasury?
Right.
And is it really the type of oil we could get from looking at existing sources in the existing fields? But,
and yeah. You, Mark Myers, would say that we were just beginning to see, and that there would be an increase.
Two parts. One is the geology controls. Much of the new fields in the 2000 periods were exploration activities or in-field delineation activities that occurred because ARCO was still around, and they were spending money to do so. and I was part of that team. And I, 1 year alone, or 2 years alone, I had seven wells that I was responsible for exploration and delineation of exploration plays. That stopped with the merger. That ended shortly after the merger, and that BP acquired the assets, and they were sold off then to Phillips, and then the ConocoPhillips merged. So we saw a dramatic decrease in exploration that had to deal with the corporate mergers. Secondly, those fields where that were found with new 3D seismic technology. I was part of that revolution as well. We were able to locate stratigraphic plays. That exploration is the kind of exploration that was being encouraged under ACES now that ConocoPhillips, BP, and Exelon are no longer doing that exploration. So it really comes down to looking at two things. One is the easy, newer pools that were closer to infrastructure, largely under the control of the majors, but not all, and were where those pools were developed. It was developed after they reached common equity among the owners of how to share the facility access fees, and so that was a big piece of it. And then they've been largely sitting with respect to expanding or looking for new oil. That's why the ACES capital credits were necessary. They timed out, and we've rescinded those exploration credits now. So the new guys aren't going to come up like they were coming up under ACES, and it was still way too early to see the results because, again, you're looking at a 10-year cycle. I will say there are other issues involved with bringing more companies and getting more exploration. The cost of using the infield facilities is extremely high. In 2004, DNR, 2003, DNR published a facility access fees, and you get charged a very progressive rate to use those facilities. The higher the oil price is, the more it costs you to use those facilities. Oh. That's why Pioneer left, and that's why E&I built separate facilities rather than use the near infrastructure that was there at Prudhoe and Kuparuk.
Oh, yeah, the our own horizontal integration. Let's go to Rich, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Rich.
Thanks very much. I wanted to say thanks first to Mark and Brad. They're doing a good job. But I would like to make 2 points, really. First of all, I hear all the time from the No on One group that ACES was broken. ACES wasn't broken. And the entire emergence of SB 21 was really an oil industry ploy. And now we're in a position as a state entity, where we're told that we should take all the upside risk in the future on what the oil production is going to be, and the oil industry doesn't take any. I mean, they're minimizing the risk when we're told constantly by advocates of private enterprise that they are the ones who are so good at taking risk. Now they want the state and the people of Alaska who own the oil to take all the risk. Where did this SB 21 come from if it didn't come from the oil industry? It only serves their interest. I'd like to hear what you say about that.
Well, my response to that is that it came from those who are concerned about the fact that Alaska wasn't getting its level, its fair share of investment that was going on in the oil industry worldwide, that production continued to be in decline, that we continued to run into a fiscal situation, and we were spending money on credits that we couldn't afford and weren't producing additional oil. It came from people who were concerned about the state's fiscal situation and about the state's economic situation.
Yeah, well, I think
you're not answering my question about risk, though.
Well,
why should we be taking the risk?
Well, right, I understand that, but you also asked where did it come from, and you know, I think it's pretty clear the governor exercised a lot of leadership on this. I mean, this is very, very high on his. Well, okay, but I mean, you just said where is it coming from, and a lot of it was the governor, and then having a legislature that was willing to do what he wanted to put in front of them. That's what happened. Okay, now to the other thing, just to get the risk, let's because we are running out of time. Brad, why don't you respond first about doesn't S21 actually shift the risk?
It actually increases the risk on industry because before, under ACES, we were subsidizing some of the producers who were coming up here to the tune of $600 million a year. And so they were their risk was being mitigated. Now the risk is on you have to put the upfront investment in, and you get your credits when you produce, when you show that you've done something with the investment you've made. So actually, SB 21 increases the risk on the producers as opposed to lowering the risk.
Okay, and so that's the answer from Brad and Mark Myers.
Well, I think Brad and I are having an opposite day kind of day.
Imagine that.
It depends on what part of the industry you're talking about. SB 21 dramatically increases the risk for new companies and for exploration and the riskier parts of oil and gas development. It increases the net barrel per profit for existing oil under most conditions, most expected conditions. for existing and proven reserves, and it also classifies a bunch of old oil as new oil, so it gets two sets of credits and lowers the effective tax rate to around 20%. So it's lower, or 20-22%, depending on how Department of Revenue ends up figuring this stuff out. It also, and both systems also are net profit share systems, so costs are absorbed. The cost risk is absorbed by the state. So in both systems, the state takes a substantial amount of risk. The state certainly foregoes a lot of upside. So in that sense, the state is taking the risks. So in the credits under ACES were largely paid for that volatility upside. And I'd like to speak to the other question that Brad talked about is producers won't sanction projects if we take all the upside. When I worked in the companies and worked on sanctioning a lot of different projects from exploration to development, we looked at stress prices. We looked at low prices, and the project had to work at low prices. We did not factor in much credit for upside because we couldn't trust it was going to be there. So ACES efficiently grabbed some more of that upside. Of course, if you're a company and you want more profit, you don't like it because it is a very much more efficient system from the state's perspective than SB 21.
I want to try to get one more call in here. Les, I'm sorry, we're just not going to get to you. Les Garrow wanted to weigh in, but I think we covered what he was talking about to some degree. Merrick in Fairbanks, it's your turn, if you're still there.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you very much for this program. This is a critically important subject that you're covering today. At a time when under Senate Bill 21 has created budget deficits that are draining our state savings at about $7 million per day.
Okay, but as we already discussed, you can't really put that on S21 yet.
Oh, I think I can because, you know, Brad pointed out that the state revenues right now are about $4 billion a year, but there is almost $20 billion worth of oil leaving Alaska per year, and Alaskans, the owners of that oil, are taking the tiniest minority share of the value of that wealth, and there's really no reason that Alaska should be having these massive budget deficits. And Mark, you correctly pointed out that under ACES, we have almost $8.5, maybe $9 billion worth of revenue under ACES that we wouldn't have as compared to the other tax.
Right. That had to do a lot with the price of oil. Okay, Merrick, I want to thank you. Brad, did we get a word in here?
Well, all I can say is that ICER said, and this is under the ACES tax structure, reasonable assumptions suggest we do not have enough cash and reserves to avoid a severe fiscal crunch soon after 2023, and with that fiscal crisis will come an economic crash. That was based on the ACES tax structure. And Mark said earlier that Scott had said that in 1985. Between 1985 and currently, oil prices jump from $5 to $100.
Yeah. Mark Myers, and get a very brief response. Hello, Mark. Goodbye, Mark.
I'm still there. I agree we need a very strong fiscal plan. However, the state simply has to capture upside in the value of its oil because it's a limited commodity of oil.
Time's
we're running up. Out. We'll eventually run out. We need to capture our
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2014 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until August 31st. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska native dancers to dinosaurs? Well, the Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy performers like Cirque Mechanics and Zuzu African Acrobats, or experience The Gathering Place, a new area celebrating Alaska's rich native cultures. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, exhibits, and good time fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.